Welcome to Syracuse Speaks. I'm Katie Zolkowski, here with WAER News Director Chris Bolt. Central New York has progressed through the four phases designed by the state to restart the economy.
But where do we go from here? On this episode of Syracuse Speaks, we speak with local officials and businesses about what reopening looks like now. They'll cover the effects they're feeling from the pandemic so far and what to expect in the future.
We'll hear from Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh, Common Space co-founder Troy Evans, and County Executive Ryan McMahon. But first, we'll hear from Lauren Koshin, Executive Director of the Museum of Science and Technology.
The Most got sudden news they had to close down back in March. They also had a somewhat confusing set of rules thrown their way regarding reopening. When I spoke with Lauren Koshin, she shared how she's navigating the pandemic, trying to offer students and local residents an important educational resource, and the importance of their mission to the entire community as science is under fire, even when we're relying on it most. Lauren Koshin, president of the Museum of Science and Technology, the MOST. Thanks for joining us on Syracuse Speaks.
Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to talk about, maybe to begin with, the current situation with the MOST and its programs. Bring us up to date about sort of where you are now after all the closing down and having to make so many accommodations because of the coronavirus pandemic.
Yep, sure. So the museum, all museums are considered a phase four. We weren't sure exactly what that date was going to be. And of course, when you're dealing with the public and your primary audience is kids, you know, everything really needs to be thoroughly planned. So at the same time, though, the county had given arts and cultural institutions, we received our permission to do our day camps. So I convened with our senior staff and our board, and kind of where we landed was, well, let's gradually reopen. And what we decided to do in that respect was really focus on the camps for the summer. So normally we're open 5 days a week, and we do three individual summer camps. Mm-hmm. They each have about 20 kids, so 60 kids. But this summer we changed it up. So as of starting June 29th, we decided to run 8 weeks of camps and do nothing but camps Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. So that'll take us basically through the end of summer. So it's three camps per week, but we have smaller groups of children because the virus spread. So, and that sort of enabled us to reopen, to start earning some revenue. The other thing I think that's great, and I think that's why we're nearly sold out, is there's actually a real need for that in the community.
Sure.
You know, there's a couple things going on there. One is parents who are less likely to be going on vacations with their kids, a lot of families that need to work. And you have kids that through the distance learning aspect really didn't get enough maybe contextualized learning, maybe enough socialization. So I think those two things really meant camps were going to be sought after. So that's how we started our reopen. Mm-hmm. And then the next step will be to reopen to the public. So what we're going to do is do weekends only for now, starting August 1st. The camps in that reopen will take us through the fall, where we, you know, we expect to have a full reopen in October.
Let's go back to the start when the plug was pulled. You know, at some point, a decision was made because of the health crisis, which hit New York harder and quicker than any other state, pretty much. What were you thinking then? Do you remember back when that happened and, you know, your livelihood, the mission you provide for children and the community, the plug is completely pulled. Do you remember what that was like and sort of the unknown of the future and how you kind of dealt with that or thought about that? I mean, professionally and maybe even personally as well.
Yes. Yes, you're dredging up bad memories. No, I do remember. We weren't thinking full-on shutdown. We were thinking, okay, there's going to be attendance caps. Maybe we reduce hours. Maybe we close off certain exhibits. And so we were somewhat prepared in that respect. And we were also prepared to, at the same time, I thought, well, what is that going to look like in terms of if we do completely close? And so we started planning ahead, and I have the most phenomenal education team here at the museum. So I said, you know, what are the things that we can put online? You know, we do a lot of little things on Facebook and things like that for putting science education online, putting exhibits online, but they actually went and took, you know, a combination of five programs and exhibits, and we put those things online. And so when we had to officially completely close, we at least had something to offer. On the business side of things, we were fortunate to get a PPP loan,
right,
which kept us whole for 8 weeks. And like I mentioned, we were a phase four. And at the time when that loan ran out, we didn't know when we were going to reopen.
Right.
Could have been a couple weeks, could have been a couple months. You know,
sure.
As we know, you can go backwards in phases.
Right.
So we did have to make some cuts to our budget, to payroll and some other cuts across the board, actually. That's where we landed in early June. So now that we're reopened and sort of back to work, we're at probably, I would say, about two-thirds of our normal capacity, mm-hmm, for as far as staffing goes.
Gotcha. Let me go back a little bit to the summer camps. What considerations did you make? What were the conversations like to say, as you mentioned before, there's really a need for this for parents and the kids', mm-hmm, educational sort of continuation, or maybe filling in some gaps educationally.
Right.
Yet, needless to say, there's health concerns, there's staff concerns, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What were the concerns that you needed to address and say, these are the things we have to solve before we, mm-hmm, can say, here's what the summer camp is going to be,
right,
you know, staffing, number of kids, days of the week, 8 weeks, as you said, which, mm-hmm, is more than normal.
So in this case, we did look for the guidance from the county health department, the New York State Department of Health. What are the rules you need to follow? It was everything. The good thing is that helped us inform our plan for our full reopen, but it was everything from, okay, how big can these groups of kids be? Are they masked? Are they not masked? It ended up being a little bit of both. The cleanliness aspect was a huge thing because, of course, normally for summer camps, we want the kids to play in the exhibits. So how are we going to sanitize and disinfect? And those were the kinds of things. And how do we keep our staff safe? Certainly from our perspective, we had parents signing waivers that they really understood, everything that we were offering.
Right.
So just making sure we're vetting everything, extra set of eyes. And so I think we came up with a really great plan.
Looking at the museum itself vis-a-vis the community and what it offers the community, you mentioned that you had some exhibits online so people could experience it that way. What is your view of how that can sort of come back so people can, again, general public, just enjoy the museum? And what's missing when we can't just come to the most?
Right. Well, it was tough. It was the programming piece was a bit easier to put online because, put some of the responsibility on you, especially if your children are interested. You know, they can download information. They can do STEM activities at home.
Mm-hmm.
The exhibits were a bit tougher because our whole approach to science education is hands-on learning, right? So all of a sudden, how do you take the hands-on piece out? And what happened in that case was really there was a couple of exhibits that were just kind of easier to move to a virtual setting.
Mm-hmm.
So my favorite actually is our innovation station. So we have a small little exhibit features mostly local innovations.
Mm-hmm.
All the way, the history of them all the way up until today. And so we turned that into a blog format instead. So, every different innovation gets some great photos and we tell a story. But it's a challenge. I mean, it's in looking ahead, it's going to be a great challenge for us. How do you keep the engagement? How do you keep it fun? How do you keep kids learning? Our reopen in August is going to look a lot different than what you might normally expect from the museum. But I think it's still going to be just as engaging. But looking ahead too, how are field trips going to change? Again, we're dealing with primarily families with young children. Are parents going to have more concerns? Are they going to be more reluctant to,
right,
come visit? Of course, things are going to have to close. When we reopen, the IMAX will not be open.
Right.
The planetarium will not be open. Our science playhouse, that big jungle gym structure, will have to be open by reservation only because we need time to clean it in between.
Sure. Yeah.
So it will be different. Our make space is actually turning into a make and take space where instead of making something and bringing it home, you can just go pick up a kit and bring,
uh-huh,
it home.
Let me move on to some larger issues and considerations. In your planning, what is the importance of the educational aspect? I don't know if that's from preschool to adult. What's the importance of a museum like this or other cultural institutions, mm-hmm, be it the Onondaga Historical Association or,
right,
the Erie Canal Museum or galleries, art galleries of various mediums? What's the importance of the education of those in the community, do you think, that, you know, has taken a hit?
Mm-hmm. I think it's unparalleled. I think the educational piece is the most important piece of what we offer. You know, we've typically thought of ourselves as both a little education, a little entertainment. The most offers something that nobody else offers. And by focusing more on that and on the education and less, if you focus more on the entertainment, I think that you'll find that families have a lot of choices.
Oh, right.
You know, and we don't want to compete against places that we can't compete against. So we focus on what really makes us unique and mm-hmm. what makes us really a one-of-a-kind institution in the community. Mm-hmm. And that is that science educational aspect that you're not going to get in a classroom.
What has the community response been to, you know, parents when they're thinking about enrolling their kids in a camp or the GoFundMe page online to, you know, try to keep some revenue going of people who would be supporters of the most? What have you heard from parents, community members, et cetera?
Actually, the response for the most part has really been tremendous. The camp selling well is a good indicator. Like I said, we're meeting a need, but also I think parents are understanding the value of a place like the museum mm-hmm. for their children.
Oh, I'm sure they're delighted to be able to have that as an opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, especially considering the fact that, you know, kids were learning on electronic devices
right.
Or a bus pulls up with a packet. We all miss that socialization piece of education or of work. The GoFundMe did quite well, again, because I think people do know we're unique. Nobody wants to see anything happen to the museum. I think people are starting to understand our significance maybe more so than in the past because I think people are sort of reassessing the value that we place on science in our community. And I think by and large, the people are starting to really understand because they're experiencing it. This is what happens when we don't value necessarily what the Office of Pandemics does for a country and for the world, you know? And so I think that the pendulum might shift back towards the days where innovation was so highly regarded and science and medicine and doctors, that work was so highly valued. And if that is the case, and I'm right in my assumption that we're going in that direction, the most has a tremendous opportunity.
Maybe finally, where do you think the reopening of the most in the phases that you've already described fits in reopening in general, both specifically in our community, but even in our brains, sort of how we mentally kind of deal with the closing down of the community, and now we're sort of inching back to reopening and, you know, whatever degree of normalcy you want to call that. Mm-hmm. What do you think the role is of the most reopening in the larger reopening mm-hmm. scheme of things?
Like everything else that we've done, I think thus far, I always believe the right answer always kind of lies in the middle. And I do still believe it'll look different. You know, you'll come in the fall, and instead of jumping into that build exhibit and building with blocks, you might walk into a pop-up science lab, and you're going to watch a demo, or you're going to see something on a tabletop, an experiment of some kind. So it'll still have a different feel, and I think it probably will until we're really in the clear. But I still think we can kind of follow the lead of the community and of the county's recommendations and still provide that great experience. And I think if people are patient as we navigate through, you're still going to get your money's worth. It's going to be different.
Well, Most President Lauren Cochin, thanks for joining us and speaking with us here on Syracuse Speaks.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
How will the pandemic change the way that we use and develop urban space? We'll hear from local leaders and business owners next on Syracuse Speaks from 88.3 WAER. Stay with us.
So the one thing that's been the most frustrating for us around Central New York, I think, is we're feeling pulled in two different directions of opinion for the reopening. And so you have the state leadership and then you have the federal government leadership, and it's not a cohesive message around the country. So it really makes you not know what's going to happen next.
Whether you're planning to hit the road this summer in search of adventure or stay home and relax, WAER will be there with you. No matter what part of the country you visit this summer, you'll know you're up to date on the latest news from home and across the nation with the WAER mobile app. Take it with you in the car, on a train, or out on the boat. Keep this coverage available to everyone for free. With a gift of support, visit WAER.org and click the red donate button to get started.
The damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I'll think about the people that are going to be affected by this, and it'll weigh heavy on my heart. I'm really disappointed that we're scratching for a 3.7% solution when we've got a lot of things to think about going forward.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks from 88.3 FM WAER. I'm Chris Bolt with Katie Zilkowski. We're talking to local government and business leaders about reopening Central New York. What will change in the city of Syracuse as a result of the pandemic, and what challenges do we still face?
To get answers to some of those questions, I spoke with Mayor Ben Walsh about reopening parts of the city, fiscal challenges, and the possible long-term effects of COVID-19. How do you think the city has fared so far throughout the pandemic, emotionally, physically, fiscally?
I think the pandemic has taken a toll in about every way you can measure it. Certainly from the city's perspective, it's taken a significant fiscal toll that we're working through. It has certainly taken a toll on people's mental health. I think the isolation that people have had to deal with both at the workplace and in their personal lives has been really difficult. And obviously it's taken a financial toll on a lot of people, whether it's in the form of people losing their jobs or being furloughed or with businesses. So it's been devastating. But as we look to the future and at the same time look back on where we've been, I think there's reason to be hopeful. And I've tried from the beginning to be very much focused on the data and letting the data drive the decision making. And when you look at the health data right now, it suggests that that the city of Syracuse and the Central New York region are relatively speaking faring pretty well.
You mentioned funding and the fiscal challenges that the city is facing, and you and County Executive McMahon have for weeks, if not months now, been calling for federal aid. When do you hope to hear about that decision, and what hangs in the balance as you do?
We have a lot riding on the federal government right now. Throughout the pandemic, one of the reasons why I think as a community we've been able to hang in there is because we've had our essential workers on the front lines keeping us safe, from our healthcare workers to our police officers, our firefighters, and at the county level, our county health department, which has done a great job. All those functions are at risk by the fiscal crisis that we're facing. The only entity that can solve our fiscal problems is the federal government. The state government is in the same position that we are, that we're in. And again, this isn't about whether you want to call it a blue state bailout or about helping bail out governments that aren't well run. Despite some of the city of Syracuse's fiscal troubles over the past decade or so, we were pre-COVID, we were scheduled to come in at the end of our fiscal year, which ended in June, with a $1.5 million surplus. That surplus has very quickly turned into a multi-million dollar deficit, and that is for no other reason than COVID. That's for that reason we need the federal government to step in and to help us to be able to continue to deliver those services so we can continue on our path to recovery.
I mean, worst case scenario, if the federal government doesn't provide funding, what do these cuts look like? I mean, are they cuts all around? Are you planning to reapportion some money to sustain certain projects? Who is this scenario a threat to directly?
Yeah, it's a threat to everyone, to our city workforce, of course, and to the constituents that we serve. So I convened fiscal contingency planning team to look at where we can find savings in lieu of federal support. And there are no easy answers here. Again, part of the reason why we were operating fiscally sustainably is because we had made a lot of tough decisions to get to that point. And so there really isn't any easy places to cut. We started the process by placing a number of employees on leave without pay, otherwise known as a furlough. The next step it will likely be an early retirement package to try to encourage those that are eligible to retire to take that incentive, and in doing so will save us some money. But those are short-term measures meant to help us to get through the next couple months. If federal aid doesn't materialize, the next steps are much more painful. There are cuts to service. There are cuts to jobs, things that would be devastating to our community. If the federal government steps in and gets us back to a level playing field, we're confident that we can manage our finances going forward. But the pandemic is unprecedented. There's nothing that we could have done to plan for or prepare for the fiscal impact, and that's why we need the federal government to step up and to help the essential workers that have helped this country get through this crisis.
So when you're talking about these cuts, is there a certain department that probably is going to feel the pain most? I mean, is there certain services that city residents might risk losing if this doesn't happen?
No department will be immune from the cuts. We have a little over $250 million annual operating budget. Certainly our larger departments, police, fire, DPW, parks, those are departments that are going to feel it, but so are the smaller ones as well. Again, we're trying to handle this as equitably and as fair a way as possible, but no department will be immune.
There were a number of projects and initiatives within the city placed at the beginning of the year. Are they being changed at all or put on hold now because of the pandemic? Is development within the city of Syracuse come to a halt in any way?
Well, that's the challenge. How do we manage the short-term crisis without sacrificing the long-term progress that we've been making? And, despite these challenges, there are a number of initiatives that are moving forward. When you look at our Syracuse Urge Initiative, which is our plan for inclusive growth in the new economy. Some of our signature initiatives, I'm very pleased to say, are still moving forward. The proposed STEAM school in the old Central Tech in the southern end of downtown. The county, the city, and the school district are actively working to get that project off the ground. The state's support remains intact, and so that's a priority that we're continuing to work on, and we expect to move forward. Some of the private sector investment that we've seen related to Surge, the proposed project from JMA to build a brand new wireless manufacturing facility on the south side of Syracuse, that work is moving forward. And again, that's part of our long-term plan to make sure that we are competitive in the new economy and in a position where we can create an economic opportunity for everyone in the city, particularly among some of our more marginalized populations. And so there's certainly reasons to be hopeful, and I'm really excited and proud of the progress that we've made over the past 2.5 years, and I'm confident once we get through this, we're going to be able to pick back up on that.
Has the pandemic for your urban development and planning office changed the way that you're thinking about using city spaces at all? Maybe less dense? The Creek Walk is a good example of what has recently is kind of adjacent to that idea.
Yeah.
The curbside pickup pilot program also heads in that direction. Is this kind of like a larger idea of how you want to recreate city space?
Yeah, there are certainly opportunities throughout the pandemic that we've had to reimagine how we deliver services, how we use public spaces. We have seen a significant increase in usage of our parks, and so we've been looking at ways in which we can invest in our park spaces to ensure that that usage continues and that it's done in a safe way. In terms of our right of way, as businesses have started to reopen, we've been looking at creative ways to use additional sidewalk space, street space, to create more opportunities for outdoor dining and for people, again, to be able to use our public spaces in a in a safe and responsible way.
Is there anything that you're looking at that you're hoping to implement to make summer in Central New York more normal? I mean, the pools have opened up, but a lot of things that people that are used to doing in the summer aren't going to be available this year.
Right. Yeah, we are. We're looking at all the services that we provide and trying to figure out ways in which we can provide them differently in light of the pandemic. The pools are a great example. We know that our pools are the highlight of the summer for many of our constituents, especially young people. And so increasingly, as the guidance came out on how we could operate our pools in a safe way, it became a financial consideration. And while strictly from a financial perspective, the right thing to do would have been to not open any, we had to balance that with, again, quality of life of our residents. And, so we made a decision to open up two pools, put a challenge out to the community to raise money to help us open two more. And because of that creativity, we're now in a position where we'll have four pools open for the remainder of the summer. Looking forward, we are anxious to know what the plan is for schools. And we've begun conversations with the school district about how they might be able to use some of our public spaces to ensure a safe learning environment. So might we have outdoor classrooms in our parks? Those are things that we're considering. How can we use additional parks facilities, including buildings, to create more space for learning? For our businesses, again, how can we use our right of way to help businesses recover? We've already started to do some increased outdoor dining, relaxing our sidewalk cafe permitting process. We've already closed one street in Hanover Square to create more outdoor dining space. We're looking at doing it in Armory Square and some of our other business districts, and in some cases not necessarily closing roads, but maybe reclaiming some of that road space that's currently used for parking and create little parklets and little contained areas for dining. So, yeah, this crisis has forced us to look at everything we do through a new lens. And while some of it I'm sure will be temporary in order just to get us through the crisis, but I suspect that there will be some long-term changes that will result from this experience that ultimately are to the benefit of the city and our constituents.
So Peace Inc. recently released a community needs assessment. The report brings in data from the NYCLU that found that three of the four census tracts with the highest infection rate were formerly redlined. They also advocate for some more systems-based approaches rather than maybe individual solutions. Do you think there are systems in place that might restrict or harm development in specifically these areas that are often marginalized and don't get the same kind of investment? And are there ways that you're addressing that for the future?
Well, there's no doubt that the pandemic has shined light on systems that have marginalized certain communities, particularly communities of color, long before this virus showed up, and has increased the sense of urgency that I have, and I think many have, to address those systems. So that's why it's so important, as we try to mitigate these short-term issues, that we keep an eye focused on what are the systemic changes that we're trying to make that will help lift up everyone in our community, again, particularly those that have been most marginalized. You know, going back to our Syracuse Surge strategy, that's based largely on the idea that we need to create economic opportunity in neighborhoods and among communities that that have not historically benefited from the investment that we have seen in this community. So, yeah, this similarly, the conversation as it relates to police reform and accountability. These are issues that have certainly had our attention from the moment that I walked into City Hall 2.5 years ago, and that I am proud that we've made significant progress on. But again, I think that the pandemic has heightened the sense of urgency that we need to address these issues. Now we need to do more, and we need to do it faster. And I'm viewing it as a window of opportunity to accelerate those systems changes that we have been working on. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to be successful in that.
I know the census has also been a big priority for your office, and right now the response rate, the last time I saw it, looks like it's hovering around 50%. A lot of the efforts that you guys had planned were canceled because of COVID-19. I mean, the in-person events and door knocking and all of that. How are you still ensuring that you're going to reach as many people as possible so that Syracuse does have the right amount of funding that it needs for the population it's serving?
Yeah, it's been a real challenge. As the pandemic has heightened the urgency on a number of other fronts, it has shined light on the importance of federal aid, and most federal aid is based on population, and so the mechanism to ensure that we have an accurate count of our population is the census. And we've been aided by the federal government extending the self-response period into the fall, but it's still really hard. Especially in communities like Syracuse, where we do have what are characterized as hard-to-count populations. So we've tried to be creative. We've done things virtually. We are doing in-person events like food giveaways and other ways that we're helping the community. We've tried to set up tables. We've had outreach workers there, just trying to meet people where they are to fill out the census and try to connect the dots to make sure people understand how what we're dealing with right now in this moment is impacted by the census process. So we definitely want to see that number go up and go up faster. It has been a challenge, but we're very much committed to continuing to ensure a complete count for the city.
What do you think is important for people to remember or consider as we're progressing through phases of reopening?
So right now is the time to double down on what's been working for us. Maintaining social distancing, wearing a mask, maintaining healthy habits, washing our hands, doing all the things that have helped us get to this point. If we do that, I'm confident that we'll be able to continue to proceed with reopening. But if we don't, it's going to just make the path to recovery a lot longer and a lot more painful.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Mayor. Stay healthy and well through this
process. Thanks so
much. Yep.
You too.
As the mayor said, our urban spaces could look different as a result of the pandemic. Troy Evans has had a front row seat to the downtown Syracuse landscape. As co-founder of Common Space, he was a partner with 100 businesses and dozens of downtown residents, all impacted by the coronavirus shutdown, including his own unique venture.
I thought to start out with, maybe I would get the idea of what the project is in terms of how people would work here, how people would live here, how that goes together, sort of your vision.
So what we've always been trying to create is a more social, humanistic way to live and work. So we provide a variety of shared office options. So you can come grab a desk, you can grab an office suite, we can accommodate up to 15 person companies. And it kind of gives this flexible social element to work where pre-COVID we were doing a lot of events, we were doing some networking things, some learning events, book clubs, things like that. So that's on the work side. On the live side, we like to say we're creating a neighborhood in a building. We do a lot of smaller units that are priced right for downtown Syracuse, but we bring this element of community to it by, again, holding like farm-to-fork dinners for our residents. We have a software where you can kind of text message all your neighbors. So you can say, hey, we're running a Wegmans. Anybody want to go? When you live or work here, you're going to get to know other people. And but by just really setting that stage, it's had people act differently. And it's created these new relationships. And when those relationships start, magic happens. And so we're all about that.
Discuss a little bit more how that social aspect looks on the ground, either as people might be working where they're seeing people that may be part of their own company, but maybe part of others sharing space, yeah. Plus the living aspect, the just after work or the Sunday morning or whatever. What do some of those things look like?
Yeah, sure. On the work side, it's we had 100 different small businesses working out of here. Right now, I think it's at 70, so it did take a dip, but it's just these cool creative collisions on the work side. So you'll run into people at the coffee pot or at the lunch table, and there's these constant, hey, what do you do? What do you do? There's data around co-working that this is valuable for people, both personally and on your business side. I think the average business revenue increases by 25% after working out of a co-working space for 3 months, just because you run into a web developer. Hey, what do you do? Hey, I need a web developer. I'll use you because you're a familiar face around. So that's kind of a lot what you see on the work side. On the live side, the people that have lived here most landed a job, don't know anyone locally, and this is a perfect option for them, either long-term or temporary, to get a social circle. You know, we're running to Wegmans, let's, you know, carpool, or we're going to go play basketball or soccer. So we have these ways that you can reach out to your neighbors so that it just creates these easier, non-awkward ways to connect. About 40% of our area is common area. So we do a shared game room, shared chef's kitchen, shared library, shared game room. So it incentivizes you to get out to these common areas, the rooftop deck or whatever, so that you run into people and you use those nice amenities.
So now in the current reality that we're in, the pandemic hit. Can you even think back at the time, whether that was February or early March, what did you have to change? How did it hit both you as a business, Common Space concept, and the specific people who lived and or worked here?
You know, at first, it didn't have a huge financial impact. We're kind of membership-based, so a lot of our members hung on for a while, like, how long is this thing going to last on the work side? But then, you know, as things became more real and you saw this wasn't going away, we had a big dip in membership, and the space got pretty empty besides myself and my partner basically coming in and keeping the space going. So it, you know, went from a pretty populated place to say 50 people a day down to zero. The good part is we're seeing that tick back up. You know, luckily we have a lot of space here. We have 25,000 square feet of workspace, you know, for 50 to 100 people. So there's lots of room to spread out.
So it is not actually too difficult as people start to come back in that you could grab a desk that's not near others.
You got it. Yep. And we've spaced everything 6 feet apart, and it's pretty easy to do here. And then we have cleaning stations. So after you use a desk, wipe it down like you would a gym.
Do you have other protocols or have you sort of changed, I don't know, not necessarily the business model, but internal practices more than that to just accommodate people's sense of, you know, everybody has a little bit of a different sense of safety and how much they worry about it.
As we get more and more data and we learn more about this thing, it's still trying to do a lot of perception activities. Like, so we always wear a mask, you know, when we do a tour or something like that. We always wear masks. We're not 6 feet apart. So we're trying to make it, even if it's not for you, you know, it's the other person's comfort level that you're trying to judge and make sure, you know, we don't want anyone to get the virus here or spread it here. I mean, that's a real concern. So we're trying to be cautious about that.
I don't know if you can answer this, but have you had a scare? Have you had a positive test of a resident or
not yet,
colleague?
But, but I'm assuming it's going to happen, and we're acting like it's going to, because it's inevitable. Like it's growing. You know, it's an invisible thing that's hard to manage. So.
So the idea of density, which this has a fairly high density if all of your living spaces are full and the workspaces, some of whom are people who live here and some not, it utilizes density really well. And there's a lot of positives we've heard about density in urban areas. Mm-hmm. It has ecological advantages, transportation advantages. You talked about the social and business dynamics. Do you have to rethink that a little bit now?
Yeah, we've definitely had a lot of those conversations. I think where we're ending up, we have to act very differently now. And we're hoping, though, in a year, in 2 years, it will be similar to what our original vision was. So it's in the current state, that's where the changes lie. We can only work with the information we have, right?
Sure. No, right. And it is changing, and there's no exact blueprint or prediction of what's going to happen 3 months out, 6 months out, 9 months out.
And I think it's our customers that are going to tell us too, you know, and so far, like, we are leasing up our new space, our new apartments, and they're leasing very well. So I think the precautions we're taking are resonating with people, and it's still a concept that people want. So that's our hope, that the business model doesn't change too much in the long term.
That is actually what I was going to ask next, is the idea of urban living, which Syracuse is really hanging its hat on. Mm-hmm. You know, business office spaces have been converted into apartments at all different price points, et cetera. What are you hearing from people? Are people still interested in kind of changing over to a little more urban centric as opposed to the suburbs of the, you know, decades past?
I think just like anything, there's no all or nothing answer, right? I think you're going to see places like Manhattan may alter a little bit, you know, in the short term, where people want to get out of the dense urban areas. I think Syracuse, I don't see that happening. It's already a pretty, you know, it's a very small urban area, so you can escape very easily to the suburbs or to a park or to a lake. A lot of our folks that live and work here are, you know, below 40, and they tend to, you know, like the social aspects of a city, you know, the restaurants and stuff like that. So it's a human need. I don't know that it goes away, especially after you've been on Zoom calls for the past 6 months, you know.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
But I know the pre-COVID, there was a massive trend to urbanization. I think they said something like 80% of the population by 2050 will live in cities. So like this pushback, I don't know if that changes drastically or not. I guess we'll find out. Yeah. Hopefully not.
Yeah, right. I mean, in terms of reopening, you mentioned that some of your business clients are starting to return. Where do you see us in terms of reopening, and how does it impact what you do? Where do you see it going? Can you make any sense of how reopening is going based on your world?
Yeah, I think I can kind of help with that. In our little bubble, it's went from nobody on the streets to now, in the past month, it's ticking back up. You can tell that the restaurants are open. There's people walking down the street. So we're probably at 25% maybe increase. I think we're not going to see a bigger uptick until fall. You know, I think daycare is a big issue for people. So if schools open again and offices are open downtown, it's just they're not, you know, forcing employees back in right now. But I think come fall, you're going to see a little uptick again in Syracuse, but maybe not back to 100% until, you know, next year, until we get a cure or something like that.
Yeah, a vaccine or a little more treatment options, et cetera.
Yeah.
To the extent you want to answer this, what kind of chasm or interruption was it for you, you know, personally or professionally?
I tend to be a pretty optimistic guy, so I did struggle with it for a while. But I think financially it definitely hurt on the work side. Everyone stopped coming to the office, so that took a hit financially. And now it's, you know, we're ticking back up with memberships. So when it's working best when people are here and you're seeing faces, and that's what we've missed. So now that that's kind of coming back a little bit, it seems like we're being successful again.
Easier to be a little more optimistic.
You got it. That too. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, maybe overall to finish, do you see, despite the uncertainties going forward, the concept still working, or where does it fit in the nature of how people are going to work and live?
Yeah, I think high level, I don't see the concept changing, because I think it is human nature to want social interaction and face-to-face. Some people can work from home or live by themselves and be completely content. Others are extremely extroverted and need to be around people all the time. I think personally, having worked from home for a couple weeks, I needed to get out of the house again. I needed to see people. I needed to not do, you know, phone calls or Zoom. So I'm hopeful that that's not going away.
All right, Troy Evans, co-founder of Common Space. Thanks for joining us on Syracuse Speaks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Coming up, Onondaga County Executive Ryan McMahon talks about some areas the pandemic has disrupted in the county and what we can expect on the road to economic recovery. You're listening to Syracuse Speaks from WAER. Stay with us.
This is Jennifer Weeks Oceda, Director of Corporate Development at WAER. I'd like to thank our business sponsors for their continued financial support. In addition to our members, backing from community organizations and businesses ensure that WAER will continue as your trusted source during and after this crisis. If you'd like to let listeners know about your current services and how your business is reviewing safety measures moving forward, consider becoming a business sponsor. Contact me at 315-443-5254.
Now that we've opened up restaurants and bars and stores, I'm watching and waiting just to see how that works out. There's no substitute for being able to be with your loved one, to give them a hug.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. I'm WAER News Director Chris Bolt with Katie Zilkowski. Onondaga County Executive Ryan McMahon held daily briefings on COVID-19 during the height of the pandemic. He's now cut down on the frequency of those briefings and focuses more on economic recovery, along with the COVID-related health updates.
I talked to the county executive about the county's current economic reality and what needs to be done in our ongoing battle with the coronavirus. I want to start with a relatively recent development, the State Fair. It typically brings thousands of people to central New York in late summer. And I know you talked about it in your briefing yesterday that getting smaller events back up and running might help to make up some of that revenue. Do you have a timeline at all on when you'd like to see these weddings and banquets happening?
Well, right now, the challenge is that you have a gathering limit of 50 people. And so we've been pushing through our partners in the state that we really need to figure out a way to get to larger gatherings, and let's incorporate the infrastructure we've built up with testing. Some of these events like weddings and other banquets where you have invited attendees, you know who they are. In the event of a positive case, it's very easy to contact trace. So one way to help eliminate any positive individuals being at these events is to utilize the testing and to test and make it mandatory over a certain number of people that they have to be tested to go to these types of events. So that's a way where we think we can do it safely and get some of this economic activity that's been on the sidelines that really our hospitality industry really needs to try to salvage any sort of year right now. Most of these businesses are just being decimated right now.
Yeah, would the county be willing to step in and maybe provide some of those tests and the infrastructure that you guys have built up and sort of have a know-how about to maybe some of these hospitality partners that would be able to host weddings or banquets?
Yeah. So we would certainly utilize our partnerships we've developed to have testing, whether it's earmarked testing for these folks, so we can be very consistent on where they should get a test and at what time, and then anticipate when they would get the results back. So this is something that we'd be willing to help take a leading role in to get these parts of the economy going again.
You and Mayor Ben Walsh have both for weeks been calling for the federal government to provide aid to state and local governments. Why do you think it hasn't gone through yet? What's taking so long in Washington?
Yeah, I think Washington's a very polarized place, and certainly you have two different parties that control two different houses. I think that what happens with the partisanship there is one house, and they both take turns, will pass a bill that addresses the concerns that people want to see addressed, but then they'll put poison pills in the bills, something they know the other party won't pass. And then it leads to delays. So what we need the Senate to do now, and I think they will, is take up a vote on support for another stimulus for local and for state governments and to put forward their priorities and then get it passed so then you can get to conference committee and get something worked out. The problem is the longer you wait, and if the answer eventually is no, we're not going to receive support, that means we have only a certain number of months remaining in 2020's fiscal year. We're a January to January year for us to make the cuts that we need to balance our budget.
So end of July, early August is the earliest that you think you could see any movement on this?
Yeah, I think they go back into session. I think July 20th, for some reason, that date's there. So I think that's the earliest, and that's really, for us, we need an answer. No's an answer. It's not an okay answer or an appropriate answer, but that at least tells us what we need to do at the local level to balance our budget. And certainly if the answer is no support, we're going to have draconian decisions we're going to have to make.
Now, the county is, as you've said, looking at a multi-million dollar budget hole. What sectors are you going to focus on for economic recovery? I mean, there are things happening in the county, like the warehouse in Clay and in DeWitt as well. So how will you see that that economic recovery in any fashion is done equitably and done quickly so people can get back to work and their livelihoods?
Certainly, we had a banner year related to the investment with our two logistics facilities that you referenced. That's over $400 million worth of investment, looking at, you know, 500 to 600 construction jobs right now that are going to be generated. And then after that, of course, you look at the full-time labor force, and we'll work with the community to make sure that that folks are getting opportunities at these positions and that there's diversity and inclusion in that effort. But in addition to that, we have a strategic project going on with Bankers Health Group in the Inner Harbor that's still happening. That's going to be 300 new jobs. We had that JMA Wireless, which is 5G manufacturing, that we put together in our south side at the Old Coin Textile Factory off of Salina Street. That's a really important project. That project's just gotten bigger. So when you look at our strategic initiatives and our big projects, the good news is that they're still moving forward. This pandemic has highlighted different opportunities related to repatriating manufacturing, supply chains for our pharmaceutical industry, and certainly our healthcare industries. And we're going to try to put forward good policy to make us attractive for further investment.
You talk about repatriating manufacturing. Are there any direct initiatives, new initiatives that you guys are working on or that are going to be in the near future for Onondaga County that focus on that?
There are. We're going to put forward very aggressive incentive packages that will separate us from other local communities that will help make the fiscal case why they should come to Central New York and Onondaga County. So stay tuned for that.
All right. You've also mentioned that there are departments like foster care and the health department that have exhausted their budgets. Additionally, if mail-in ballots are as available and as popular as they are in the general election, as they were in this past primary, they're pretty costly for the Board of Elections as well. How is the county going to fund these basic and essential government services, especially if federal aid doesn't come?
It's difficult, and it's even more difficult whether you like the policy or not related to the early voting laws that were passed by the state last year. The reality is that costs money, and the first year they gave us money in the budget, this year they did not. So it already put more of an unfunded mandate on us here at the local level. And so this is all challenging. And when there's laws in Albany where they pass laws and they don't look at what the price tag is locally, that's really not a fair process. And that happens a lot, even when people like the policy. And we always say if it's worth voting for, it's worth paying for. This is a challenge. Our BOE, we'll see where it ends up at the end of the year. Hopefully there will be some COVID-related funding for that because of the change of the process. And I think there was a little bit of COVID funding that may have came throughout the year already, but certainly we'll anticipate and expect more. But to your point, no one was talking about contact tracing in the beginning of the year. Nobody was talking about mobile testing sites in the beginning of the year. Certainly nobody was anticipating that the court systems would be shut down for 90 days. So your ability to move kids into safe and healthy homes in our foster care hasn't existed. So that costs us a lot of money to keep these kids placed in a safe way. So these are all costs to the pandemic that nobody could have budgeted for because nobody expected the 100-year pandemic to show up.
Peace Inc. recently released a needs assessment for the community, but the report brings in data from the NYCLU that finds three of the four census tracts with the highest infection rates were formerly redlined, and this comes before the recent New York Times article that found there are 64 COVID-19 cases per 10,000 Black residents in Onondaga County versus 20 cases per 10,000 white residents. Are these racial disparity issues something that your office plans to address or focus on? We have largely done well in this community, very comparatively.
Yeah, well, when you look at the pandemic, though, you're looking at data and you're looking at intentional efforts. We put the first mobile testing triage site. It was open before we had cases, and it was opened in minority neighborhoods. So the reality is the numbers, how it's impacting the minority community in our county, are much better than other counties our size because of the decisions we did. When you look at mobile testing sites, how we're going into specific minority neighborhoods, these are all things that we did. And when you do those things, you're going to find hidden pockets of the virus. So you're going to find infection rates when you're testing more in one community than the other. What we found when we looked at data in this process in the city of Syracuse is that we were under-testing white neighborhoods in the city of Syracuse. So we did the opposite approach. We wanted to find pockets. We saw what was happening in other parts of the country, in large cities, how it was impacting in a disproportionate way the minority communities. Part of the issues related to some of these infections come to household contacts. When you have a situation where folks are in a rental unit where you can't isolate with your own bathroom, you're going to have a higher percentage of household contacts, and that is what has happened, and that is what has driven some of the numbers. But when you look at what we've done intentionally, we did things in the beginning to make sure that all of our minority communities had testing that other communities just didn't do. So we're very proud of our efforts there.
Looking forward a few months into the fall, how is the county supporting individual universities and colleges? Do you have any concerns about the amount of infrastructure that needs to be in place in order to test all of these students?
So we've been working with Syracuse University and Lemoyne College and obviously Onondaga Community College. And we believe that testing needs to be part of bringing back the kids to campus. And we think that we've developed an infrastructure that can do that with the right phased-in, reopening of the campuses. So we're comfortable with that. We think that that's how we'll know. And, of course, if you're bringing back in 15,000 kids, you're going to have kids who are positive, whether they're symptomatic or asymptomatic. Living with this virus is figuring out a way to get back to normal. That testing and tracing infrastructure is here. We've built it up. We need to utilize it.
There definitely is a sense of confidence in the community. Given community spread numbers, hospitalizations are down. It is trending in the right direction. Is there any way that you have found that works getting through to people, that they actually do take it seriously?
Yeah, I think the messaging is important. I think it was easy when we were doing daily briefings and the governor was doing daily briefings. You heard the messaging. Also, there was extra motivation related to reopening the economy for people to be compliant so we can get back to work. We still have businesses on the sidelines, so I've been trying to message that. If you want to get back to your gym, we want to get these malls open. We need to keep our data where it is and have it get stronger. And I think our data merits these things opening up at this point. I've seen the community always do better with a carrot approach rather than a stick approach. And so the carrot is to get the economy going up and to understand what's at risk if we have to go backwards. And it's these liberties that we have and that we've missed that may go away. And so I think certainly the communication, getting to full implementation of the economy is an important step where we can show the community this is what this is why we work so hard, so we get these things back and we get this part of our lives back.
Well, County Executive, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you so much for your time. Stay healthy, stay well.
Thank you. You too.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.
Just as the coronavirus quickly arrived and overwhelmed health, government, and business leaders, there's no blueprint for reopening and recovery. As you've heard, there's no shortage of planning and contingencies to those plans as well. One common thread might be cautious optimism to come through the pandemic, threatened, of course, by a resurgence, and counting on federal aid to avoid further economic struggles.
If you want to hear this program again or listen to past Syracuse Speaks programs, you can go to our website, waer.org. Syracuse Speaks is a production of Syracuse Public Media. Our executive producers are Kevin Kloss and Joe Lee. For WAER News Director Chris Bolt, I'm Katie Zolkowski. You're listening to 88.3 FM, WAER Syracuse.